Hey everybody, Jason here. Before we get started, I just want to plug something that just happened. So I had this episode in the can, but a new episode, or more precisely, a new podcast, I guess, came out, although it's on the feed of a different podcast. So the guys over at Analytic Dice, in addition to doing their once a month picking a game and playing it, they are also doing interviews of influential people in the game space, game designers and the like. And the first episode has Kevin, Assault Heart Games, and Burn 2D6 fame, interviewing John Gilmore, who does Kids on Bikes, among other things. Really interesting interview. It's on the standard Analytic Dice feed. I will put a link in the show notes. Check it out. It's a great interview, and I look forward to the next one's coming up. Okay, now let's get into the show.
What pops up a beer or a cold libation? Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings. Full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on. Contests and of course you know it's all about games. I said, slow down, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Podcast. The other Jason.
Welcome back to the Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today is mostly a call-in episode, a number of callers talking about a number of different things. Great, great episode. But before we get to that, I want to highlight a couple products, including a mostly player-facing product, because one of the complaints that is super valid is that most media created is for the Dungeon Master, for the Game Master. And so we have a book that's been published that's kind of mostly aimed at the player. There's some DM-facing stuff in there, but mostly it's for the player. So I want to talk about that. There's an update to another product I want to talk about. And I want to highlight a new podcast. So let's do that first. The new podcast is from Riley, who we're going to hear from later in this episode. But the podcast is called Diegetic Advancement. There are links in the show notes both to the Spotify feed and an RSS feed. So you can take that RSS feed and put it in any podcatcher to get that feed. It's an interesting show. The first episode's out, and it's broken up into different segments. One of those is talking about the dreaded Quantum Ogre and why everybody gets it wrong. Very cool show. Highly recommended. Go check it out. Now, let's talk about some physical products. The source I have for them is on Amazon, so there'll be Amazon links in there. These are physical products. They're not PDFs available. So for those of you that are all digital, you're going to miss out. But for those that like to have a physical book in their hand, this is for you. These two physical products I'm going to talk about are by Ron Christopher. Now, he's part of the Grog Talk Empire, and we're going to talk about Grog Talk and that empire at the end of the episode, but there are links in the show notes. You've heard me talk about Smoldering Dun Games and Flipping and Turning numerous times. Some of the things in these books actually have appeared in Flipping and Turning, but most of it is original content. The first thing I'm going to mention is the Old School Compendium has been updated. A while back in, I think, April, I discussed the Old School Compendium, Ron's Old School Compendium. Again, there are links to all this in the show notes. And what this is it is just his house rules. It's original monsters, spells, magic items for first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, or you could use it for Osric, or, you know, pretty much for any old school game, right? And we have additional spell lists for different classes. We have, like I say, monsters. We have a bunch of new magic items, things like that. These books are formatted so they match the original editions, the TSR first edition stuff. The way the columns are set up and the font and all that matches the TSR era stuff. The way the monster stat blocks are in here match that. So what we don't have is art. So be advised ahead of time. There's no art in here, But other than that, it looks like you're picking up a TSR book when you pick one of these up and read it. Now, back in April when I talked about the Old School Compendium, it was 148 pages. Now, it's 217 pages. There are numerous editions, new monsters, spells, magic items. It's $20 for the paperback, $25 for the hardcover from Amazon. Definitely, if you want more stuff for your game, highly, highly recommended. The other product is... So that one is kind of more DM-facing, honestly. I mean, the spells are kind of player-facing, right? But the other product that's kind of interesting is Ron's Old School Reader. Now, Ron's Old School Reader is also available on Amazon. These are print-only, and again, we're talking $20 for the paperback. The Old School Reader is very interesting to me because what it is, again, it's formatted like the TSR books and all that, but it's basically... I don't know how to explain it. It's almost like a Best of Dragon magazine, right? Remember when you'd pick up, or maybe if you go back and get one of the old Dragon magazines, they had the Best of Dragon. And that's what this reminds me of, or those old Best of Dragon, where it has a number of articles in here, a number of essays in here that are grouped by subject. And that's really what this feels like, is a mega size, super-sized Best of Dragon. It's 172 pages. It has, I think, 44 total essays in here, or articles in here. These articles are broken down into 9 sections. There are 8 articles about player characters, talking about races, classes, levels, ability scores, things like that. There are 2 articles on spells, on their use and acquisition. 6 articles on monsters and their place in the game. 4 articles relating to the DM's role and game rules. Like I say, it's not all player-facing. 6 articles about in-game activities, strategies, and various ways AD&D is played. There are 2 articles about items and how they're used in the game, which these, and pretty much all these except like the DM section, are all for the players, right? Now, this next one's not. There's how to create for the game, so 6 articles in the process on how Ron creates new monster spells, magic items, everything for the game, which is kind of cool. There's 11 new classes in here, usable as PCs or NPCs. But like I say, most of these articles are kind of PC-facing. They're written for the player, so which is really cool. Highly, highly recommended. I think there's some great stuff in here, some great nuggets of knowledge in here. And then the book closes out, the end of the book. So we've got basically 150 pages of these 44 articles, right? And then the end of the book, the last... 22 pages, 20-some pages of the book, are Ron's Old School Quiz Book. Almost 250 trivia questions based on the 3 core AD&D books. And you could use this in all kinds of cool ways. Obviously, you're not going to use it in-game, but these are pretty great. Just basically, it's, if you're going to do trivia night, if you're going to have a party with your players, if you're going to do whatever, these are... they have the questions and then they have the answers like anything else. And, some of these these questions are things like, the Paladin's Warhorse has how many hit dice, or which form of undead creature has the most hit dice, or what's the armor class for ringmail plus shield, things like that, right? All kinds of different questions, though. I just read a couple out of here. There's a ton of questions with the answers that you could use this for all kinds of ways you can use trivia questions. But that's kind of neat. But the bulk of the book, like say 150 pages of Ron's Old School Reader, are actually articles and new classes and things. And the vast majority of these articles, I don't know what percentage it is, but the majority of these articles are player facing. So if you're in old school games, especially AD&D or Osric, and you're interested in being a better player and knowing more about the game and how it's designed to work, or tricks and things you could use in the game, these articles are very useful for that. And the fact they match the look and the font and all of the TSR era books is great. So, highly recommended, Ron's Old School Reader and the updated Old School Compendium. Again, the links are in the show notes. So, I told you this part of the show would be kind of short because I've got a bunch of calls. This is going to be a long episode, but a great episode. So let's open up that mailbag.
Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Who's on the phone? Well, maybe it's your auntie or a joke by your spouse, but the operator's scream is coming from inside the house.
Hey, Jason, that was a fun question you put forth for AD&D 1st Edition, the recharging of magic items. So it does say on page 132 in the Dungeon Master's Guide, I guess you can only read this if you're a Dungeon Master, ha ha ha, that most of these items can be recharged by spell uses of sufficiently high level. And then they have a nice little short table, rods, 50 charges, minus a factor, staves, 25 charges, wands, 100 charges. And also, I mean, what I'm going to say is superseded by individual descriptions of certain items. For example, like a rod of cancellation, right? It's a one-use type of item. Once it drains an item, it itself becomes brittle and is no longer potent. So then after that, I did some digging, and actually, I do have to say that the AD&D has a pretty good index, and I wish more games had fine indices like the AD&D book does, because I was able to track down what I was looking for. And it does say on page 116, under fabrication of magic items, including potions and scrolls, that high level, when Gygax says high level, he means a wizard of 12th level or an illusionist of 11th level, a high priest, a druid, etc., at about 11th level. So you have to be pretty substantial in status and stature and level in order to recharge an item. So if we go rules as written, and I would say then that's when you get to the rulings that in order to be recharged, a wand is probably the easiest because they usually have like one particular spell. So you need that spell and you need to cast that spell over and over to recharge that wand. There might be even a research step that you have to do. It says, and you can go to and refer to previously in making magic items, there's a section, magical research, starting on page 114, and you can go through there as a GM with your player, and after they consult a sage, or do their own research, maybe adventures, you know, would be that research, or would be part of that research, then you would have to get to the researching and figure out the cost, the length, etc. Because some, especially some of the rods, like a rod of lordly might, like how many different spells does it take to recharge that? Or staves, which have multiple powers, like the staff of the magi, for example. Although that one I think is probably a special, right? And it kind of tells you how to recharge it. But maybe I think ultimately I would rule that as long as you are of high enough level in power, say, for example, for Staff of Power, right, it has multiple powers, put magic item, it has all these powers, Continual Light, Magic Missile or Lightning Bolt, Darkness, Brave Enfeeblement, Levitation, Cold of Cold or Fireball, and all those do like one charge. So I guess when you cast those spells into the wand back, after you figure out how to do that and the cost of that would be, then they'd give one charge back. And then shield, globe of invulnerability, paralyzation, shield 5-foot radius, that is, could do that. Or paralyzation, right, would give two charges back. That's just one example. So same thing with, you know, staff of curing. You could put cure disease, blindness, wounds, etc. back into it. So I would say, based on what is written, you would just have to recharge with the spell that you're going to be casting out of. But of course, you don't cast that spell. The energy from that spell just gets absorbed into the item. I think another curious thing is that you need to keep track of how much you use. And of course, it is somewhat unknown to the player character that if a rod, staff, or wand is completely drained, then it crumbles to powder as the last charge is expended. So you kind of need to keep track of those charges. Or at least think you do. Because it looks like there is about a 20% unknown factor built into when you find an item and how many charges it has left. So pretty cool. Pretty cool system. I definitely want to play some AD&D because I don't think... I mean, I feel like I played a lot of it, but there's definitely some rules we didn't use, maybe because we didn't understand them. And it'd be good to go through some combats because of the, you know, segments and casting times and, of course, you know, minute-long rounds. So yeah, good stuff.
Hey, Carl, great call. I think you really nailed it. The only two things I want to add to this. One is, as you point out, you never really know how many charges are in an item unless you're the one that originally created it, because the DM tracks the current number of charges, not the player. And that's something I think is important to do and important not to tell the player, because there is that chance of overcharging it and, you know, catastrophe happens, right? Also, and there's also that variability, is this going to be the last charge or not? And I think that definitely adds to the game. The other part I would add is, the only restriction I think I would put on people recharging items, I wouldn't make them cast enchant item before casting the spell to recharge it or anything like that. But I would make them be whatever level that item's spells are assumed to come out as. So wands come out as 6th level spells. Staves, I believe, come out as 8th level spells. You know, rings are 12th level spells. So you would have to be that level to recharge that item, because you had to put in the power of a 6th level spell into wand to be able to recharge it, if that makes sense. So that's the only other restriction I would put on it. But aside from that, like I say, I think you really nailed it. Thank you so much for that call. But Carl has more to say.
Hey, Jason, I'm using SpeakPipe today because easy button. But it was funny listening to, not realizing that Joe Richter was talking about Crawl. I'm like, isn't that the plot for Stargate? So Joe Richter, they've already remade that movie. It's called Stargate. Yeah, it's very similar. Maybe not Stargate the series, but Stargate the movie. You know, pyramid landing, taking over world. Yep, Stargate.
Is Stargate a ripoff of Crawl? Or is it a ripoff of Tritax game, Fringeworthy? Buy the game, you be the judge. By the way, there is a series of novels set after the Stargate movie continuity, separate from the TV show continuity. There's 5 or 6 of them. I have them all. They're pretty good. Highly recommended. Of course, they're well out of print, but you should be able to find, you know, used copies for pretty cheap. Okay, back to Carl.
More SpeakPipe, because this is another short one. I love Joe's reminder of the Black Plague. I was looking at stats just inspired by his podcast reply, and so upwards of 200 million people could have died during the Black Plague, and that was in a very short span of time. And that was about close to 50% of the population in Europe. So it's like, you look next to you and that person's dead. You look to the person not next to you, but then one past them and that person's dead. I mean, that would be devastating if 50% of the population died. For sure in the modern era, because there's so much dependent on technical expertise, but then same thing, right? So if 50% of the population died around you, there'd be so much emptiness. It would be really freaky and apocalyptic, and you'd be like, where did everyone go? So pretty cool for Joe to bring that up and mention that. But that's kind of the ramification of the Black Plague, right? Mid 14th century, it would have been post-apocalyptic until it was recovered sort of, you know, towards the beginning, really. It took 50, maybe 100 years to, like, you know, and that sparked what the 100 Years War just took off right after that. So, you know, there you go. Apocalism. Apocalypticness.
Hey, Jason, it's Eric, Omega 3D Chicken Coop. I just wanted to jump in on the discussion regarding post-apocalyptic again, because I listened to Joe and Carl, and they made good points, because I'll consider a more narrow focus on what I consider post-apocalyptic, and it aligned with what you clarified after that. I guess when I was originally commenting on it, I took it as there was an advanced civilization and it has fallen, and now we're playing in our fantasy world that is closely related to like medieval Europe. And And while I have added like old, like really highly magical kingdoms and places that were more advanced from that standpoint in a setting, I've never done like, their spaceships crash landed somewhere in this fantasy setting. So that's what I was thinking of when you were talking about post-apocalyptic. And it sounds like you and I were kind of on the same brainwave on that part, but I do really appreciate hearing Carl and Joe's viewpoint on it, because yeah, their viewpoint is that there are other civilizations that have had their own apocalypse and have fallen, and the other civilizations are built upon them. So those were good thoughts, and I appreciate them calling in.
Yeah, Eric, that's where I was going for with post-apocalyptic. I don't think we've had post-apocalyptic in the common era or, you know, in our timeline that we're aware of written history from humanity. I don't think we've had an apocalypse, right? Was the, you know, whatever caused the death of dinosaurs, that kind of thing, an apocalypse? Sure, but that's, we don't have written records from there, probably. I don't know. Joe, from hindsightless, do we? But realistically, in the past, you know, few thousand years, we haven't had an apocalypse. Let's be honest. We've had, you know, great tragedies, you know, huge events that have caused deaths and things like that, but we haven't had an apocalypse. And actually, we're not even using the word apocalypse right, but I'm stealing a little bit of thunder from MW. Now, you're going to hear MW at the end of the show. I'm going to let him close the show out with a rant. But he is going to be putting out an episode where he's going to talk about the word apocalypse and what it really means and go into this. So once that episode's out, I hope folks check that out over on the Worlds of MW Lewis. I don't know what date that episode will come out, but I know it's in the preps. He shared a little bit of that with me. It's interesting stuff. But anyhow, it's all good. I was thinking, as I clarified in an earlier show, more of a high advanced civilization that's gone, and now you're in a lower tech civilization that's recovering that. Whether it was a high tech magic, can't talk. Whether it was a high magic society like Eric's thinking, or a high science society like I'm thinking, or a mixture of the two, doesn't really matter. But the idea that when you're digging the ruins, you're finding the artifacts of this previous civilization. And we don't really get that with, you know, after the Black Plague, right? So that's not saying what Carl and Joe are talking about isn't interesting and isn't useful for gaming, because it 100% is. It's just kind of a tangent to what you know, we're talking about when we talk about post-apocalyptic kind of society for Dungeons and Dragons. Anyhow, that's enough on this. Let's move on to the next topic.
Hey, Jason, I was going to call and talk to you about Conan the Barbarian, and then probably we'll watch Conan the Destroyer again, and then Red Sonja, to give you three separate calls. But first, a brief rant. I was looking on eBay because you mentioned Unarticana, because every time I listen to your podcast, I end up buying something. And I'm like, man, I want to run some AD&D kind of 1.5, because that's what I had the most fun with, using the Forgotten Realms gray box. And then when we dove into the OA product, Oriental Adventures, we kind of used, you know, 1.5, the Wilderness and Dungeon Survival's Guide, because there was non-weapon proficiencies in the OA book. So, my rant. So why would I go on eBay and pay $40 for a reprint that I can get through drive-through for $18? Because I'm not going to get a chewed up. I mean, I feel like I used to have Unearthed Arcana, the one with like Mordenkainen, or is that Tasha? No, that's Mordenkainen, right? Or is that Tensor? Tensor maybe. Anyway, mine fell apart. Right, it was really bad binding, and then like these. Even my player's handbook that I have, I don't have the original player's handbook with the cool statue cover and someone with the Elminster or whomever on it. I have to be careful with it because the pages are loose.
Carl, that's a good point. These days with print on demand, it doesn't, if you're a collector, it makes sense to go out and get the original books. But with print on demands, there's really not that urgency when you can just go and get a reprint of it. The print on demand aren't great quality either, let's be honest. And some of the older TSR books are really good quality, but there are some there in the mid-80s, like Unearthed Arcana in that era, that do kind of fall apart. They have a tendency to fall apart, so that's not good. My understanding is some of the early 5e books also fell apart. That's one advantage of Palladium books, is that, you know, the covers may peel a little bit, but the Palladium books are pretty darn solid. And Palladium Fantasy is basically Kevin's house-ruled AD&D, and a lot more interesting in a lot of ways. So I definitely would recommend, if you want a book that lasts and something that's really interesting, to pick up first edition Palladium Fantasy. Okay, let's switch over to BJ of the Arcane Alienist.
Hey Jason, it's BJ. A couple things. One, I apologize for missing the Kroll call-in. I'm late to that. I watched the movie, and then that was over the weekend. My family, that was when we did our some family activities for kind of an early Christmas. So I wasn't able to get the call, and I just ran out of time. But I think I kind of agree with what a lot of the reviews from the time were, that it was, you know, the production values and the special effects are really pretty good considering the year it came out. But yeah, the plot does suffer from some gaps, some inconsistencies, some things that don't make a lot of sense. But it's still a fun movie, and it was also particularly interesting to see Robbie Coltrane and Liam Neeson in early roles in that movie. But for me, Kroll, I don't think I even was aware the movie existed. My first knowledge of Kroll was the arcade game and that sort of creepy image from the poster of the beast's face kind of superimposed on the mountain, or the base of his fortress. But I knew it as an arcade game, and it must have been sometime later when I actually saw the movie on the shelf at a video store. I was like, oh, that's a movie. And probably even for a brief moment was kind of, okay, is the movie based on the video game, or is the video game based on the movie? You know, because, I was a kid at the time. So, but anyway, sorry I missed the call-ins, but that's my response to Kroll, mostly just to point out the video game. And then also kind of wading in late on the discussion about gold versus silver, or using another standard, something other than the gold standard in D&D. I think the only time I've ever thought about that, because, you know, you think about it, you're like, oh, well, they didn't really trade in gold. Well, then you get into, well, they have to come with a barter system, because you want to be really authentic. A lot of commerce in a medieval world, you know, winds up being, I think, at least among peasants, there's probably a lot of bartering and trading going on, because they don't have a lot of cash on hand. So they're sort of doing that, you know, bartering and trading with their neighbors or kind of local people in their community, right? And every country is going to have a different standard. or maybe even every town, you know, it's just going to be you could get really unwieldy really quick if you didn't use a standardized system the way they do. But, you know, for gold, I think MW had a good point. Like, well, who's to say gold is that rare? Maybe it is common enough that it's a common coinage. It's probably, more valuable than, say, aluminum or tin. Maybe not so rare and so precious that it can't be the standard currency, right? But the only time really I've ever thought about changing it was not really to completely rethink the system. It was simply to think, you know, I had a group of players who did not really seem interested in domain play. They really weren't interested in building a castle, starting a temple, starting their own guild or Wizard's Tower, anything like that. And so what happens is the perennial problem in D&D forever is you wind up with these characters who are just, by a certain, you know, not very, don't have to get for a few many levels until they're just filthy, stinking rich compared to everybody else. And you're like, why would you even adventure past, you know, third or fourth level? You're already wealthy, you know, just ridiculously wealthy by the standards we're typically given in D&D for what things cost and how much, you know, peasants and laborers make. So the way I thought to adjust that, if you wanted to do a game that still used XP for treasure, but you didn't want everybody to be so flush with cash, would be that you would change it to a silver standard. And all you do is you just divide the value of treasure by 10. That's all you got to do. Just whatever the random treasure is, whatever the if you're running a module, divide the value of the treasure by 10. Or just say whenever it says gold piece, replace that with silver, with copper, you know, silver replaced with copper. Well, then you still get left with what you're going to do with copper pieces, right? But it's really simple math. So just divide the total value by 10. And then you give, and then standard gear, also you just, you know, if it's listed as cost in so many silver, gold, that's what it costs in silver. If it's listed as so many silver, that's what it costs in copper. If it's listed as a price in copper, you just drop it to one copper piece. You know, again, you're just cutting things down by 10, factors of 10. And so common goods are now, whatever it's listed in gold, that's the price in silver. But more expensive stuff, like if you wanted to actually build a keep or you know, buy a ship or one of these big expensive things that typically only a very wealthy person would have, leave those as they're listed in their gold piece values. And what that does is, I mean, this still exists the possibility, you know, how much that stuff's cost if somebody wants it. But if someone wants just to be a, you know, an adventurer and remain kind of among the common folk, and you don't want them just having tons of cash around, well, your XP is based on the silver you collect, so you can still level up. We're just going to reduce the amount of treasure, so you know, it still scales the same way it does for gold, except you're now not, you know, independently wealthy by the time you're like third or fourth level, right? And so that just fits with a little more kind of, again, kind of a modern game where people don't want to pursue becoming a lord or building their own strongholds and attracting an army of followers and retainers that they have to give salaries and provide for, things like that. So again, I actually never implemented that. It was just the only thing I thought about it when I had a group that didn't seem like they were really interested in the long-term domain play. And I thought, well, here's a way I can do that and still give them a reason why they have to go out and work a little bit, at least, you know, for a while, because they're not sitting on a mound of gold all the time, right? Anyway, just a thought on that. Again, I don't see a reason to actually change the system so much as you just adjust the scaling based on the kind of game you want to play or the kind of campaign setting you want to reflect. All right, well, I've rambled on long enough. I'm enjoying all your episodes. I'm still listening, even though I haven't called in as much as I used to. I'll try to get better about that. Talk to you later.
Hey, BJ, thank you so much for that call. Really appreciate it. Glad to hear that you've been getting some episodes out lately. Folks, go check out the Arcane Alienist, BJ's show. He's been putting more episodes out lately. Great content. No worries on missing the Crawl episode. If you get a chance, send something in for Conan. That'd be great. Of course, everybody, the next movie night is Conan. Any of the Conan movies. Could be Conan the Barbarian, Conan the Destroyer, even Red Sonja counts. The thing from 2011 with Jason Momoa that calls itself Conan, that counts. So call in with whatever you want. Doesn't matter. It's Christmas. But I need all those calls by the 22nd of December, because that episode, of course, will come out the 25th of December. You know, as far as the gold-silver thing, sure, it's easy enough to just switch gold and silver and adjust things. And it's not that it's hard to change it. It's just, why? You're not playing in Earth. You're not playing in the real world. So just use the game. Play the game. But you know, if it makes you feel better, if it makes your players feel better, if you're playing like a Mudcore game where everybody's life sucks and you're not allowed to have nice things, then maybe you don't want to be on the gold standard, and that's okay. You know, there's not, if it fits your campaign, folks, then definitely change to a silver standard or a copper standard or change to all barter. There's nothing at all wrong with that. I guess my rant was more the idea that there's nothing at all wrong with the game as presented either. But BJ is not saying there is. So I don't want to put that on BJ, because that's definitely not what he's saying. But thank you so much for that comment. And you're right. It's super simple to change if you want to. And people should definitely change the game or change the rules to fit the game that they're playing. Over on the Pink Phantoms podcast, Phantom Thoughts, he's been reading a book called Muster. And there's a lot of things in Muster I don't agree with. There's some things I do. One interesting thing he said in a recent episode when he's reading through there is they had the philosophy, you know, don't identify the game with a rule set, identify the game with itself and have the rules that work for your game. So, you know, it's not that you're playing AD&D First Edition, it's you're playing your campaign, right? And there's a lot of sense to that. And there's a lot of sense that if in your game that silver standard makes sense, then that's the way your game works. And again, I'm not telling anybody having a silver standard's wrong. That isn't my intent, but I guess my intent's more that there's nothing wrong with the gold standard in the base game either. But now I'm circling around and eating my own tail, so let's move on to the next call.
Hey, Jason, this is Dark Fluid. Just taking a little time to call in. I listened to your show on the Rule Cyclopedia and Beckman and just wanted to comment. 4 years, even going back to me, the Rule Cyclopedia was always came back to as, in my opinion, the single best role-playing game product ever put out. Not necessarily the best game, the best rule sets or whatever, but as a product, it was just so nice. It was all self-contained, everything you needed to run, pretty well laid out for the time. I thought amazingly laid out when I compared it to AD&D, even first and second edition books and the other basic stuff. It wasn't the best intro, but we already talked about that. So I just wanted to put in that some of the things that stand out to me are the stuff in Beckme that is brought out in the companion, which would be the fighter optional maneuvers or fighter combat options, I think they're called. Things like the shield bash and the I can't remember what it's called, smash, I believe, where you add your strength. But more importantly, the ability of the fighters above certain, I'm going to use the term Thaco, but basically levels, to add the additional, I don't know what the right term would be, what the number that they rolled above their armor class to hit to their damage as a bonus. And it helped scale the fighters as it went up. I thought those were really interesting things that I've never seen really kind of readdressed in a lot of other games that, potentially fix some of the problem with high-level fighters. I will say as I continued to mature and learn about new games and as new things came out, specifically the retro clones, I really think that the retro clones have kind of, as far as products and organization, done a really good job organizing and making the older versions, say OD&D and BX, more readable and better to use. And so, I think these days I probably lean towards that more than Beckme and the Rule Cyclopedia. And I also see how, in my opinion, the expansion in Beckme up to those higher levels kind of messed up some of the thief progression and some of those other things and the scaling of the game in comparison to BX, and I probably lean more towards BX these days. But anyway, this call is already running too long. I could talk more about my nostalgia for Beckme and the Rule Cyclopedia especially all day, but those are the most interesting things to me about it. Thanks. Oh, and one more add-on. I'm going to look that up. Wait a second. I'm going to look that up before I say it again. Okay, sorry about that. Fighter combat options, smash, parry, disarm. I wonder, are those the first essentially feats in D&D? Or I'm kind of curious to hear if anybody else knows. Were there other feats prior to that or another supplement that added something akin to feats? To me, that's the first instance of quote unquote feats, if you will, in a D&D product. But anyway, sorry for the extended rambling. Talk to you later.
Dark Fluid, thank you for the call. As you can tell, extended rambling is very welcome on this show. We'll have more of that later in this episode, so there's not a problem at all with that. I appreciate the feedback. My original intent, of course, with that was just to highlight a couple interesting things in the Rule Cyclopedia. It wasn't like an extensive review of it or anything, obviously. It'd be neat to do an extensive review of Beckme and Rule Cyclopedia, Beckme being the box sets, the Mensur box sets, Basic, Expert, Companion, Master, and Immortal. Whether that's on the cards or not, it's probably not, to be honest. That's a pretty big project. It'd be neat if somebody wanted to do that at some point. I don't know that that's realistic in the purview of this show, but we'll see what the future brings. Who knows? I don't know where feats first appeared. That's an interesting question. Or where the proto-feats appeared. That's the bigger thing, right? Proto-feats honestly probably appeared somewhere in Dragon Magazine, but that's an interesting question. Does anybody know where the first feat or proto-feat appears in the Dungeons & Dragons ecosystem, in any of the Dungeons & Dragons games? Was it some of these skills and some of these fighter abilities in Vecmi Rule Cyclopedia? Was it somewhere in AD&D 1.5 edition, you know, Oriental Ventures and Unearthed Arcana Forward? Was it something in Dragon Magazine? I don't know. I'd be interested to hear people's thoughts on that. Thank you again for the call, Dark Fluid. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Jason, it is Eric of the Omega 3D Chicken Coop. I'm calling in to discuss Wizards and Swords. I get Daniel's point, right? Like, if I go into a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu gym and I either have limited skill or no skill and, you know, even a blue belt, well, frankly, even a white belt in some cases, and I go after them, I'm probably going to be pretty ineffective, right? Or if I go up against the black belt that's running the gym, he's going to be able to turn me into pretzels and I'm not going to be able to do a single thing. So yes, a wizard with a sword swinging against a, you know, a competent fighter that is ready for it and not taking him, you know, too lightly or whatever. Yeah, the wizard's probably not going to land a blow. It's like me trying to land a punch on, you know, Sugar Ray Leonard. It's not happening, right? Or if it does, it'd be extremely lucky. So, but still, there's a lucky chance there. So, I don't think it should be out of the question that they couldn't happen to land a lucky blow. But to Daniel's point, what if two wizards are fighting off against swords? Wouldn't they be able to hit each other then, since they're both pathetically equal at sword use? Just a thought experiment there. And I think the last thing I'll say about it is, I've always seen it, isn't that the point of the base attack bonus and Ortheco or classes that give armor class bonuses because of their fighting prowess? That's how I've always interpreted it, right? Like, if a wizard picks up a sword, they're likely fairly weak, right? So they're getting no strength bonus. They likely have a low base attack bonus. Now, the D20 die is fairly swingy, and that's kind of the way that, you know, D20-based games work, is that you have a wider variety of outcomes because, you know, you're not using like a 2D6 system or a 3D6 system where you have a, you know, a consistent bell curve. So, that's just kind of how I look at it, is like that's already baked into the game as far as the base attack bonuses, right? So if a wizard and a fighter are fighting, one, the wizard has way less hit points, likely, especially in the old school games. And if they're level 6, they have probably 12 hit points, assuming they didn't roll a bunch of 1s or a bunch of 4s, right? And if the fighter's there, they probably have double the hit points. And if they have a con bonus, maybe 2.5-3 times the hit points. Plus, they're wearing armor. So, I mean, the wizard's going to have to get incredibly lucky when taking into account Thaco, strength bonuses, armor class, if they were to get in a sword fight with a fighter. So that's why it doesn't matter to me that a wizard attacks a fighter with a sword. Sure, he might get a lucky hit in or two, but in the grand scheme of things, he's not going to do any significant amount of damage to harm them. And the other one I was looking at was, oh man, was it online on a forum in a rule book? Or I don't know if someone said it on the podcast, but the other idea you could use is, you know, someone who's not proficient in the weapon does half damage with the weapon because they're not effective at wielding it. So while they might be able to impact it, they can't hit it cleanly. And I'll give you an example. So I golf in an indoor golf league, just started this year. I golf with my buddy who's a good golfer. I am an okay to bad golfer. And what's interesting is we're doing an indoor golf monitor, which has a simulator, and it monitors everything, club head speed, tack angle, blah, 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 all the same things. So him and I are using relatively good equipment. We're using the same golf balls. And what's interesting is him and I will swing the same golf swing speed, but he will hit the golf ball 40 yards further than me because he's squaring it up better and has a higher proficiency and skill level with it. So even if we were equivalent strength and could swing a sword at the same speed, if he's better with the sword, he's going to do more damage because he knows how to get the edge on alignment, knows where to strike, etc. So I think that would also be another good compromise for non-proficient weapon users, is that the damage of the weapon is halved because it would also mimic their ineffectiveness at wielding the weapon. Did I have any other thoughts on this? I do have thoughts of clerics and not being able to use edge weapons. It's never made sense to me because a flanged mace is pointed and some of them have edges on them. And it's not like you're hitting them with this ball of metal and it's not harming them. So the whole concept of like, oh, I can't use an edge weapon because I can't draw blood is kind of dumb, because if you bash someone in the skull with a mace, I'm pretty sure there's going to be quite a bit of blood and gore. Anyway, this call's getting kind of long, so I'll leave you there with those thoughts. Thank you, man. Take it easy.
Eric, thank you so much for that call. To address your last point first, you know, the clerics not being able to use edge weapons is just a game mechanic, a balancing mechanic. It is what it is. A lot of people house rule around that. That's up to them, not a problem. Unlike Daniel, I kind of think that the non-weapon proficiency penalty is enough as far as the combat use. So if somebody wants to pick a weapon up and have that minus, they're a magic user and they have that -5 to hit, and they want to try to use it in combat, knowing they're wading in there with no armor and stuff, hey, more power to them, right? Now, as far as the half damage idea, that actually comes, it might come from other places, but it's in Rule Cyclopedia. So that's kind of how they handle that. If you don't have proficiency in a weapon, in Rule Cyclopedia, you do half damage of that weapon. You don't have a minus to hit. Now, there is a minus to hit for range weapons, but you just do half damage. So that's where that kind of comes from. The other way to go around that, like Daniel said, I don't remember if this is a call-in or this is on his show, but was the idea that you would just do D4 damage as a wizard no matter what. And that works too. But I think I would let them do full damage, honestly. They would just have... It depends on the system you're running. So I'm going to always default to AD&D First Edition. And in that system, you know, your magic users are going to have a -5 to hit with any weapon they're not proficient with. If we were running Rule Cyclopedia or Beckme, then I would probably go with that half damage thing, because that's what that rule system uses. So that's kind of where that goes. Thank you so much for that call. Really appreciate it. Now we're going to go to Riley, who has a new podcast out that I talked about at the beginning of the show.
Hey, Jason, Riley here. I thought I'd give you a quick call on your latest episode, and particularly the skills discussion. I've got a couple of points to make. One, thieves, as you and I both know, ruined the game, but I think they can be saved. Joe from the Decahedron podcast, in his recent episode, talked about giving all classes access to level 1 thief abilities, just the same as the magic user and the thief and the cleric are all just as good at hitting things as the level 1 fighter. Kind of makes sense that everyone could be as good as the level 1 thief. Also, it kind of grates me that the thief is on a D100 for their skills, but the other skill-like abilities in the game, like listen at doors, are in X and 6. So I kind of favor moving the thief over to X and 6, like Lamentations or the OSC Cargo Scrawler variant rules. On a universal skill system that, you know, you could plug and play, I actually think that the system from Fate, or a system inspired by that, is probably one of the better options. So you take a character concept. Let's say I want to be a ranger who protects the woods. That's my character concept. And just in discussion with the game master, decide that they should be good at tracking, herbal medicine, and maybe a couple other things. You can tack that on to just about any game system. Game master is going to have to interpret if that's going to give you some mechanical bonus or if that's just going to be left up to GM fear. I think, you know, different games lend themselves to different ways to go. So I don't think having any hard and fast rules for a universal system like that is the way to go. I think that tacks on really well to some of the stuff that Daniel talks about, where, you know, he's pretty adamant on sticking with just the original classes. But if you want to play something else, then you just say you're playing that thing, and then Daniel takes that into consideration when he's thinking up the odds. So the one thing I'll go with you on as well is the when you're playing solo, having a more defined skill list and mechanics, hard and fast mechanics around that is really helpful. Leaving things up to GM fiat when you're both the GM and the player is just a road to favoring yourself and getting the outcome that you want. Anyway, keep up the podcast. I'm looking forward to Conan Christmas. I haven't actually watched any Conan movies before, so it'll be a good opportunity for me. Anyway, talk to you later. Bye.
Riley, thank you for the call. I envy you being able to watch the Conan movies for the first time. It's amazing. So I look forward to hearing what you think if you do have a chance to watch them. If not, maybe for a Conan Christmas, then please talk about them on your own podcast. So, as far as the skills go, yeah, you know, the system that you mentioned there actually works a lot like Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, the secondary skill system that's in the Dungeon Master's Guide, right there on page 12, where you got secondary skills, and it's kind of up the DM to figure out how to apply those secondary skills. And, you know, those are things like Forester, or Gambler, or Hunter, Fisher, Sailor, Shipwright, Trader, Trapper, you know, Woodworker. So that's kind of that system. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that system. And what I like about the skill list in the Dungeon Master's Guide, we're talking about AD&D First Edition, folks, is that these are not action skills. These are background skills, secondary skills, just like it says. So now some of these are more useful to an adventurer than others, like Armorer, Emboyer, Fletcher, you know, where you can make bows and arrows and things, Trapper, right? But these aren't necessarily, some of these are skills that definitely could affect, I take that back, some of these are. So if you're a teamster, you're going to be better with, you know, pack animals and things like that, and horses pulling wagons. If you're a navigator, that's going to help if you guys are on a ship, or if you're maybe lost or trying to navigate by the stars. So some of these are more useful than others, definitely. But that said, none of these are like night fighting, blind fighting. None of these are stealth, right? None of these are game-breaking skills that make you better than another character in their specific domain, right? None of these skills are going to make you better than a magic user at magic user stuff, unlike what we see in the Rule Cyclopedia skill list. So I think this is actually a good skill list. I think what Riley sets forward works as well. That's really similar to like Barbarians of Lemuria, which is my favorite system for sword and sorcery, like Conan, where in that one you have careers, and anything that falls under that career's purview, that career would apply to. So a sailor could, you know, navigate by the stars, and a sailor could tie knots, and a sailor could swab the deck, and a sailor could curse and drink, and, you know, swim, right? Anything a sailor could do, then, although a lot of sailors couldn't swim, but that's not the point. The point is that, yeah, I like that system. I don't know. We'll see. As far as thieves go, yes, they did ruin the game. I'm a long-term hater of thieves. I like OD&D without the thief class. But that said, you know, they're part of the game now. We have to accept that. They've been part of the game since a year into the game's lifespan. And they're here, and they're not going away. The Lamentations way of handling the thief actually is really good. I know people give Lamentations of Flame Princes a hard time. They have issues that with the creator and stuff that we're not going to get into here because a lot of that's ridiculous stuff. But the big, or people don't like the tone of Lamentations, or don't like the art, or don't like the kind of shock jock radio thing that we have with the modules. And I think all that are totally valid reasons not to like Lamentations of Flame Princes. But you can get the art-free, free-of-cost version of the rule set, and it's one of the cleanest, best BX clones out there. And Lamentations is a really great base rule set. Even if you don't use any of their modules, even if you don't use any of the other, you know, quote unquote bad stuff. You know, I don't want to get into that discussion on the show, but is a base rule set. Lamentations is a really good base rule set. Anyway, so I got off track here a little bit. The other thing with skills, so Mark reached out to me on Discord. It was an email. Mark reached out to me with an email on skills. So I am going to read that to you here. And Mark actually sent me a BX clone that they are working on for them and their group. And what Mark says in the email, I love the latest episode where you guys are chatting about skills. I wanted to chime in. I thought a voicemail would be too long. Ha ha ha. Have you listened to my shows, Mark? So I wanted to send over a copy of my house rules for you to check out how we handle skills and other things in our game. I think you might enjoy it based on the commentary in the episode. Document is a work in progress. Interesting content, I'll send you updates, yada yada. Thanks, and looking forward to more great content, Mark. Mark, thank you so much for sending this, and we emailed back and forth a little bit. I'm not going to talk about this house rule document because it's still in progress, and I'm not sure if Mark's going to publish it, what they're going to do with it. So I'm not even going to mention it. They've got a cool name for it, but I'm not going to ruin any of that. I will say it's kind of based on the SRD 5.1. It's very well done. There's art in here. It's very nice. I hope it does get released at some point. But it's basically a, you know, house ruled BX is what this is. And it's pretty neat, pretty well done. There are actually a variety of neat things in here. And without permission, I don't want to kind of talk about some of these custom classes and things in here. But Mark had mentioned the skill system. So I think I'm safe to talk about the skill system that's in here. And what we have in here for a skill system is basically ability checks. And what we have, and I'll just read off here. At certain times during a venture, you may wish to have your character do something out of the ordinary. This could be jump across a large gap, hiding, climbing a cliff, etc. Depending on the feat you want your character to accomplish, one of the character's attributes correspond to it. Here are some examples for each attribute. So for strength, we have opening doors, feats of athletics, swimming against current, dexterity, feats of acrobatics, hiding, sleight of hand, constitution, drinking games, holding your breath underwater, intelligence, you know, seeing if the character knows the history of something, searching for a particular object or thing, knowledge on religions, wisdom, if you think somebody's lying to you, tending wounds, tracking and survival, charisma, negotiation, persuasion, intimidation, acting and performing, leading troops or fellow party members. And what they do here is the referee or the DM or whoever's running the game, whatever we're going to call them, is going to assign a difficulty rating to the task. And then you roll d20 and add the appropriate modifier from the associated ability score. If it meets or exceeds the DR number, you succeed. And then they go down and give example difficulty ratings. Easy is a 7, medium is an 11, hard is a 15, for example, right? So you roll d20, you add your modifier, which is generally going to be, you know, depending on the skill. Now, in their game, it goes -3 to +3. So, like, a 3 is a -3, and 18 is +3. In other games, like, say, OD&D, you go from, like, a -1 to a +1. So it depends on the game, but it's definitely not going to break anything. And even the high scores, like where you get a +3, doesn't make you so much better at doing these tasks than somebody else, because all you're doing is adding a 3 to a d20 roll. And as variable as that d20 roll is, that may not give you a huge advantage. So I think this is a decent way to go. It's kind of generic, and it is the ability score thing, but I don't think it's as bad as systems, or not bad. I don't think it's bad at all. But I think it avoids the problem of ability score systems where you roll under your ability score. Because in systems where you have to roll under your ability score, obviously the higher your score is, the better you are at it. Where here, yeah, you're a little bit better at it, but you're not that much better at it, because the most you're getting is a +3, which isn't nearly as good as having to roll under an 18 compared to roll under a 10, right? So, very cool. Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate that. This rule set's really neat. They even spell out with their the rules, like what happens if you get a hold of another magic user spell book, stuff like that. Lots of neat stuff in here. Hopefully we'll see the light of day, but you know, it's not my place to share it at this point. But I will say that lots of people are doing lots of fun things with their home games, and I love to see that. I think that's really cool. Okay, we have one more call, but I'm actually going to give you my outro now, and I'm going to let MW from the world's MW Lewis close the show out. So I want to thank all my callers or everybody that's reached out. Thank you to all my listeners. Thank you to everybody for putting up with this kind of long episode here. I had a lot of calls, wanted to get to them, a lot of feedback. And I really appreciate all the feedback. There are tons of ways to send in feedback. You can send an email, as Mark did. You can send messages over voicemail. There's a Google Voice number in the show notes. There's a SpeakPipe link in the show notes. You can send a direct message over Discord. There's a link to the Audio Dungeon Discord in the show notes. You can go to Spotify for Podcasters and send it through that page. There's lots of ways to send messages. I'm happy to receive them any way you want to send them in. Thank you to TJ for the wonderful music. Thank you to Ray Otis for the great clip art. The coffee cup clip art Ray Otis provided for me, and I really appreciate that. And this, let me give you a little bit of context for this last call here. It's combination, the should magic users be able to use sword things and skills things and all that. And MW kind of wraps into one kind of long call. He also refers to the Grog Talk Empire and a lot of the Grog Talk stuff. So in the show notes, you'll see I talk about the Grog Empire in there. And there are links to all that stuff in there. Grog Talk is a YouTube show where you had James and Dan, who were the Grog Talk Emperors. Now there's just James because Dan had to step away for a little bit. But they put on Grog Con, which is a convention, an AD&D first edition based, although other games are played, gaming convention that happens at the end of September every year down in Florida. So very cool group. They also have a Discord channel where we do all kinds of great things, have all kinds of conversations. The conversations MW's talking about happened on the Discord channel. I think I'm the one that mentioned that the rules don't actually say that he's going to mention, but that's neither here nor there. So check all that stuff out. If you're into AD&D, especially first edition, then Grog Talk stuff is really cool, well worth your time. There's also the official magazine of Grog Talk, Flipping and Turning. You can get the digital issues for free, or you can get print issues from Smoldering Dung Games. I've talked about them in podcasts before, and links are in older podcasts, but check that out. Flipping and Turning is a really cool magazine with, you know, fan-generated magazine about AD&D First Edition. There are interviews from people that worked at TSR in there. There are, you know, rule suggestions, adventures, all kinds of great stuff. So it's really worth your time. Okay, all that said, I'm going to turn it over to MW. So be excellent to each other, and I will be back on Sunday with another show. Take care.
Jason, it's MW here. I gave you some call-ins to preview that I'm going to put on my show so I don't muddy up your show with long call-ins. So MW here, Worlds of MW Lewis. So this whole thing, why does this come up? This whole thing about the sword. Well, first of all, the colonel here was... not the kernel person, but the kernel, like piece of corn kernel, was Eric's call-in. And I even said, I don't even know what he was referring to from a prior show of yours, but I'm glad he called in to talk about the skills. And when he was talking about the skills, he mentioned this sword thing. So why did I call in and leave that ridiculously long explanation? Because this happens in real life. The problem is things are said by people like James the Emperor, who, you know, I have the utmost respect for him, even though my trial's pending. And I hear I might have committed a capital offense even. But nevertheless, I love the Emperor and I respect the Emperor. And I respect the Gibbering Mouther and what's written in the Gibbering Mouther. But respect's not the same thing as always acquiescing. I don't always agree with the proclamations and the explanations. So why does this come up? Why did I go on an impassioned, lengthy discussion of this? Because when these things are said by someone like James, and he has a following of people, like hundreds of people, thousands of people follow and listen to his show, and like Gary, there the proclamations of Dan and James when it comes to old school AD&D, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, starts to become mythically the law to a bunch of people who want to run the game the old way. So that's what I encounter. So I never, this whole issue of picking up the sword by the magic user, or a cleric maybe using a piercing weapon to kill a vampire, right? Like, who would want to penalize a cleric for using a piercing stake to kill a vampire? I would always allow that in my game, just not even in when I was younger with my friends. And we weren't playing Gonzo style or Monty Hall style, but we would just play the game, and sometimes it'd be like, well, it doesn't really make sense that my cleric can't kill the vampire because he can't use the right tools. And it'd be like, okay, we'll just go ahead and use the tools. Like, who cared? We didn't care. Like, go ahead, just do it, right? Or the magic user might pick up the sword in that moment of, and then there's somebody on the Grog Talk channel that keeps insisting, why would a magic user want to use a sword? You're right. Magic users generally, in my games, magic users pretty much never want to use a sword. But, you know, that's the same. Why would a player want to do something a thief does? Well, because every once in a while, shit happens and something happens and the circumstances throw a curve and players do things interesting and unexpected, and lo and behold, they're in a situation where they might want to do something that previously you didn't think they'd want to do, or they didn't think they'd want to do. So when this is when this happens, this stuff boils to the surface periodically in your game, and it did in my game. And I said, okay, well, I think in this circumstance, your cleric would go ahead and use the silver dagger because you don't have anything else to use, and the people who were using the edged silver weapons are now incapacitated, right? So, like, the only choice you have is to fight the lycanthrope. And then someone is saying, like, why would you put them in that situation to make them use the edged weapon? And I didn't put them in the situation. It just, the situation evolved on the ground, and the cleric was the last one standing. And the magic user. So neither of them really were positioned well to fight the lycanthropes. And so then I kind of say, we'll go ahead and just use it. But then my players who are ingrained, and they've come out of the Grog Empire. I got these players out of the Grog Empire. And I start getting argument from them. Well, I can't. And that's what they're literally saying, I can't. And they didn't ask me. They didn't say, well, in your game, are you going to penalize me XP if I do it? Or they don't say, in your game, are you telling me it's feasible for a cleric to use this kind of weapon where I've always thought it's impossible? Because so I don't even understand why they're telling me they can't. They're just like, I can't do it. And then I'm like, I think logically, I'm like, well, that's kind of dumb. Of course you could pick up the bladed weapon and use it. It may not be permit it for your class, and we all don't know why. Like, everybody speculates there's reasons why, but and then so this is why I don't want to get into the argument anymore. Like, I don't care anymore. But the point is, this is why it comes up, because these proclamations are made. So I really went to town in the how to play this week, demanding someone show me the language. Where is it written you will lose your XP points? Now, you brought up the multi-class situation. And I thought of that. I actually thought of that. But I thought that doesn't really apply to these situations we're talking about, except what you just said in your show. The cleric or the thief, the cleric or the magic user, or even the thief, decide to deliberately always use a prohibited weapon. Then I think you're starting to get into that multi-class situation. And instead of withholding XP points or not giving them, which was the proclamation of the Emperor, I would say you're now gaining XP as a fighter and you can no longer be a magic user. I wouldn't ever really, because again, I would, and so finally I got somebody on there saying, yeah, I don't think it's really written that you don't get XP points when these situations bubble to the surface and something odd happens. And because I'd go even further. I was kind of under the impression until this came up that using a weapon that says it's prohibited in the book, I kind of always meant that means you can never be proficient in it and you would just suffer the normal proficiency hit. And I'm the dungeon master. Like, I'm the one you would think would be more of the antagonist. oh, well, the rule said you can't use it, you can't. But I'm the other way. I'm kind of like, I don't really think that's what the rule meant. I don't really think the rule meant you physically can't use it. But maybe the player was arguing with me because they didn't think they could physically, they didn't think it was impossible for his character to use it. Maybe they thought I was tricking them. Maybe they thought I was giving them a moral dilemma. Like, should I use the blade and not get XP points? Or just not use the blade and still hope I live and get XP points? Because I don't play that way. I don't make Sophie's choices in my game. Like, aha, you either do it and I'm not going to give you the XP points, or you don't do it and you're going to die. I don't play that way. I never play that way. I was like, I kind of was very honest with them, and we kind of had a discussion. I think because you're the cleric and you're chaotic, you know, you're a good character, that you would do whatever it takes to prevent an evil character from killing your good companions, even if it goes against your training. I really wanted to say, I just think you get a non-proficiency penalty. But there's all this lore and there's all this fictional reasons why, or Gary said this or that, why the cleric's not supposed to use the piercing weapons. But the fact of the matter is, the book itself, the rule book itself, both DMG and Player's Handbook, doesn't actually say why the cleric can't use the piercing weapon. And we all know it's probably just game balance. That's what the book should just say. It should just say, to balance out the character classes, each class will have different weapons they can use that they could become proficient in. But that doesn't mean they can't use the other weapons in circumstantial. To answer that one guy who keeps saying, well, why would they want to? Why would they want to? No, they generally don't want to. My players are not carrying around weapons they're not proficient in. Even the fighter, like my fighters don't carry weapons they're not proficient in. They generally just want to play with the weapons they're proficient in. And in my experience, I find fighters don't even add weapons as the game goes on, even though they can add more weapons. They generally just don't use more weapons. Players are kind of lazy that way. But the it's circular. This all gets to circumstance. So anyway, Jason, great call. Another thing you said today, I love. It's beautiful. Don't roll for skills if you want them to succeed. This has been discussed a million times on your show, other shows. I hear it all the time, and I agree. If you want the players to do something, don't roll the skill, right? Don't make it hard to open a door if you actually want them to go through the door. And if it's okay that they don't go through the door, then the players need to accept that they can't open the door. They should go back. So you said, I love what you said. I was getting ready for work listening, and I'm like, that's great, because that's what I've been doing recently. If it's a skill you know they're eventually going to succeed at, like opening doors. If you have six people and you know eventually a one and a two is going to come up. And if you have a fighter with better strength, it's a three, or it could be a four or five. You know it's going to come up. So my player's kind of, oh my God, he's making us roll these open doors again. And I'm having them go through a scenario now where the doors are all jammed, because by rule, if a dungeon's doors are not, they're not supposed to be easy to open. And I know this is getting a long call, but so to get to the point, I say, okay, we know you're going to not stop until you open the door. I'm just going to roll a die. I'm going to see how long it takes you. I roll, okay, it's going to take you four rounds. So in four rounds, you bust the door open. Why? And why does that matter? Because I do keep track of time for wandering monsters. That's all. That's the only reason why it matters. It doesn't matter any other reason. If I wasn't tracking time for wandering monsters, I'd just say, okay, you eventually open the door. I wouldn't even roll how long it would take. It wouldn't matter. But if you're playing and you want to roll wandering monsters every 10 minutes, they're in the environment, then you have to know how long certain things take to do. And if the players are hemming and hawing, they don't want to roll and fail five times in a row opening the door, and then you're saying, well, that was 5 minutes, that's why I'm asking you to do it, you could just say, okay, like I said, I consult with the players. I said, okay, you guys don't want to sit there and keep rolling until you hit the number. Because just like playing a slot machine, eventually the number's going to come up, right? We know it's going to come up. I say to them, how about I just roll a D4 or D6, and I'll figure out how long it takes you to jam this, bust this damn door down. And they say, fine, just do that. And they know why I'm asking. They know I'm keeping track of time for wanderings. So You know, the game is not a mystery. People play the game long enough. They know the mechanic. They know what mechanics in play. So they say, yeah, just go ahead. We know you need to keep track of the time. So just roll and tell us how long it takes us to get the door open. And then they can sit there and continue to watch YouTube or text message or read something else on their computer monitor. Well, I do all the hard work of tracking and detailing the game and how the game's unfolding. Because then and then they get to do what they like to do. They can roll to see if they hit. That's what they like to roll for. They don't like to roll to make saving throws or skill checks or anything like that because there could be really severe consequences. Players just like to do and win. That's so players say DMs are antagonistic, but let's be honest, the players are the ones that are antagonistic. They don't really care about all the stuff the Dungeon Master has to do. They only care about the stuff they want to do. You know, listening at a pesky door and failing, that's not fun. They always want to know what's on the other side of the door. How'd I fail? Anyway, I'm really digressing. The fact of the matter is, us DMs, we got a bad deal, man. It's a bad deal being a DM. It really is. So, thanks, Jason.
And remember, folks, if you sent a call into Jason and you haven't heard it on this episode, have no fear. It will appear.
Your auntie or a joker by your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. I want some. Here is a dice man in your moilers by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to hell.